The Worldly Philosophers by Robert L. Heilbronner. Continued.
Disc 9.
The theory of economic development launched Schumpeter on an academic career that was to be interrupted only briefly, just after the First World War, by a foray into government and business. In 1919, he agreed to join a commission on the nationalization of industry established by the new socialist German government. A young economist asked him how someone who had so extolled enterprise could take part in a commission whose aim was to nationalize it. "If somebody wants to commit suicide," Schumpeter replied, "it is a good thing if a doctor is present." In that same year, he was asked to become finance minister in the newly formed center-socialist government of Austria. He worked out an ambitious plan to stabilize the Austrian currency, but conflicts and disagreements forced his resignation before the plan could be approved. It would probably have failed. Nothing could have arrested the inflationary juggernaut gathering momentum at that time. There followed a brief stint as president of the Biedermann Bank, a private bank in Vienna, but that was pulled down by the storm, as well as by the dishonesty of some of his associates. When the bank went under, its new president found himself personally in considerable debt. It is characteristic of the aristocrat that he paid his creditors in full rather than hiding behind the bankruptcy laws, although it cost him his capital, and that he continued to pay his debts from his income over the next 10 years. To add to his personal misfortune, he now married the charming 21-year-old daughter of the superintendent of his mother's apartment house, with whom he had been in love for 5 years, and whom he had sent to schools in Paris and Switzerland to equip her to be his wife. And within a year, she died in childbirth, a loss that further darkened Schumpeter's already saturnine personality. Thereafter, his real career began, first as a visiting professor in Japan, then in Germany, soon thereafter at Harvard, where his manner and his cloak quickly made him into a campus figure. It was there also that he married Elizabeth Booty, herself an economist, and finally it was there that he declared the Depression to be a good cold douche, a remark that at least one young student never forgot. The Depression was, in fact, a test of Schumpeter's ideas. If capitalism derived its energy from the innovations of entrepreneurs, why was their stimulus missing in the grim years of the 1930s? Keynes had said that depressions reflected the state of expectations of businessmen, but his theory did not require him to account for the reason why their animal spirits were low. Schumpeter had a more demanding task because he explained boom and bust by the bunching of innovations and the swarming of businessmen. The endless depression, therefore, cried out for reasons why the new innovations were failing to arrive on time. Schumpeter leaned on two explanations in Business Cycles, a 1,000-page, 2-volume work published in 1939. Partly, he attributed the severity of the depression to the fact that there were not one but 3 different kinds of business cycles, one of quite short duration, a second with a rhythm of 7 to 11 years, and a third with a vast 50-year pulse associated with epical inventions like the steam locomotive or the automobile, and that all 3 cycles were touching their respective bottoms at the same time. A second reason was the negative impact of external factors, ranging from the Russian Revolution to generally inept government policy. These latter were outside the reach of business cycle theory, but they contributed nonetheless to the gravity of the situation. It was by no means an unintelligent assessment of the crisis, although the phenomenon of swarming as the cause of business cycles was never well established. But Schumpeter's book interests us for quite another reason. It is that capitalism, like any other social system, does not live by bread alone. It requires a faith. In its case, faith in the values and virtues of the civilization that capitalism produces, and that in turn reproduces capitalism. And despite the economic success of the system, this faith was losing its mobilizing force. Thus the book ends, once again, on a contradictory note. Judging purely on an economic basis, capitalism still had a long run for its money. Indeed, as Schumpeter says in the next-to-last sentence, if his schema of 3 interacting investment cycles was correct, the next 3 decades ought to be much more buoyant than the last 2. Then comes the disconcerting last sentence, but the sociological drift cannot be expected to change. We already find hints of the argument in his theory of capitalist development, and more than hints in business cycles. But the fully developed vision of the future of capitalism does not emerge until 1942, when Schumpeter published Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, a book that changed the way we think about the system. The book begins with Marx. Oddly, Schumpeter, who was the most self-involved person, defined his intellectual life not so much for himself as against others. Keynes was his immediate bête noire, for Schumpeter was not only philosophically opposed to the Keynesian vision, but personally irked that Keynes attracted the attention and admiration of the whole world, while he had to content himself with the recognition of his academic peers. Rather uncharacteristically, he could never bring himself to award to Keynes the credit that was his due. When the general theory appeared, Schumpeter reviewed it with scrapings and bowings to the master, one of the most brilliant men who ever bent their energies to economic problems, but with an unbecoming, and worse, uncomprehending dismissal of the book. The less said about it, the better. But the real antagonist in Schumpeter's intellectual life was not Keynes, but Marx. Schumpeter had studied Marx in his student days, and had participated in seminar discussions with scholars such as Rudolf Hilferding and Otto Bauer, two of the most brilliant young Marxist scholars of their day. He was more deeply familiar than any Western economist with Marx's work, as it was then understood. Much of that work, let us recall, did not appear in the Anglo-American world until the 1950s. During his Harvard years, he was always ready to discuss Marx with his younger colleagues. Indeed, he was more open-minded about Marx than about Keynes. So it is little wonder that Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy begins with Marx as the only opponent truly worthy of his steel. Marx the prophet, Marx the sociologist, Marx the economist, Marx the teacher. Those are the four chapters with which the book starts. Perhaps it is already evident where the two men will agree and disagree. For Marx, the very essence of capitalism is dialectical change and self-created disequilibrium. All this is grist for Schumpeter's mill. Indeed, Marx's conception of capitalism's imminent development is undoubtedly the source of Schumpeter's view. But Marx places the cause of this dynamism in the struggle between the working class and the owning class, a struggle that continually squeezes out surplus value and thereby motivates all capitalists, not just pioneers, to rescue their profits by labor-saving innovations. Here is where Schumpeter departs from Marx. He offers another view of the system, one that stresses the bourgeois side of capitalism, not its insatiable and rapacious aspects. For Schumpeter, this bourgeois component was the cultural expression of the rational, hedonist businessman, whom he viewed as the very antithesis of the swashbuckling, glory-minded warrior. The evolution of the bourgeois style of life, he writes, could be easily, and perhaps most tellingly, described in terms of the genesis of the lounge suit, a remark worthy of Veblen. Thus, in Schumpeter's view, capitalism does not achieve its all-important thrust from its central figure, the bourgeois capitalist, but from an outsider, an interloper, the upstart entrepreneur. Marx or Veblen would have doubted the difference, but it is crucial to Schumpeter's interpretation of the system. We need not linger over other differences with Marx. Schumpeter may not have an exact measure of his opponent, but it is clear that he has outlined a formidable intellect who must be met and bested on his own ground. And that is precisely what he sets out to do. For we turn the page after the chapter on Marx the teacher to read, "Can capitalism survive?" Now the answer comes with a double shock. No, I do not think it can. But if capitalism is doomed, it cannot be for the reasons that Marx sets forth. And so we embark on a tour de force description of what Schumpeter calls plausible capitalism. What is plausible capitalism? It is much like a carefully reasoned scenario of the very prospect that Keynes has already laid before us, a scenario of the possibilities for a century of growth. Here is Schumpeter at his absolute best. The fears of the stagnationists as to vanishing investment opportunities are set aside with an airy wave. The conquest of the air, he said, will be as great as that of India. The worries of other economists about the sclerosis of spreading monopolization are similarly sent flying with the description of capitalist innovation as a perennial gale of creative destruction, in which the agents for innovatory change are the monopolies themselves. The stage is thus set for what appears to be a direct refutation of Marx. Plausible capitalism is a reasoned model of an economic system that is caught up in a process of continuous, self-renewing growth. But now comes the Schumpeterian contradiction. Capitalism may be an economic success, but it is not a sociological success. This is because, as we have already seen, the economic base of capitalism creates its ideological superstructure, rational rather than romantic, critical rather than heroic, designed for men in lounge suits, not armor. In the end, it is this capitalist frame of mind, this capitalist mentality, that brings down the system. Capitalism creates a critical frame of mind, which, after having destroyed the moral authority of so many other institutions, in the end turns against its own. The bourgeois finds to his amazement that the rationalist attitude does not stop at the credentials of kings and popes, but goes on to attack private property and the whole scheme of bourgeois values. And so the great entrepreneurial adventure comes to an end, not because the working class has risen up or because the system has finally been unable to master a worsening succession of crises, but simply because the atmosphere has changed. Personality and force of character count for less, bureaucratic management for more. Innovation itself becomes institutionalized and reduced to routine. The bourgeois family, the great transmission belt of capitalist values, becomes infected with the disease of rationalism. The bourgeois class loses faith in itself. Thus, while things are going well at the surface, there is a tendency toward another civilization that slowly works deep down below. Once again, we turn the page. Can socialism work? Of course it can. It is a very Schumpeterian kind of socialism, a benign, bureaucratic, planned economy. We will talk about it briefly later. But notice the remarkable thing about Schumpeter's argument. He has beaten Marx on his own ground. He surrenders to Marx in what seems to be the crucial point of contention, namely whether capitalism can survive. But he has bested Marx by demonstrating, or at least arguing, that capitalism will give way to socialism for Schumpeter's reasons, not for Marx's. Marx is accorded every honor, but Schumpeter's view nonetheless carries the day. Does it? The question is of huge importance, not merely to appraise Schumpeter, but because the prognosis affects ourselves as residents of the system about whose fate Schumpeter is writing. We begin with a sense of dazzled admiration mixed with irritation. Schumpeter cannot resist attitudinizing, whether he is tweaking the noses of good bourgeois conservatives or of Marxist zealots. He uses his book to air a great many pet ideas. Marx is a great conservative. Monopolies increase the sphere of influence of the better and decrease the sphere of influence of the inferior brains. The more completely capitalist a nation is, the less likely it is to be aggressive, a judgment that will interest students of 19th-century British imperialism and 20th-century American foreign policy. But these characteristic flourishes must be set in perspective by reflecting on the argument as a whole. Does not that argument have the ring of authority? Does not the prospect of an immense, unexplored technological frontier, of a drift toward bureaucratization in business as well as government, of a waning of the bourgeois ethic and a weakening of its élan, strike us as uncannily prescient? Remember now that the book was published in 1942. As a seer, Schumpeter is without equal in his time, at once putting to shame the heady expectations of the contemporary left, who thought that capitalism was on the way out, the naive hopes of the contemporary middle, who believed that a modest application of government spending would fix things up once and for all, and the black forebodings of the right, who saw us headed down the road to serfdom. Nonetheless, the Schumpeterian prognosis is a very uneven one, less impressive on close examination than at first sight. There is no doubt that Schumpeter was right in foreseeing a wide-open technological future, but he did not foresee that the quality of that technology, from nuclear arms and energy to computerization, might pose considerable dangers for capitalism, as well as fields for investment. There is no denying his prescience when he spoke of the impending growth of bureaucracy in big business, but it is by no means correct that the rise of lumbering giants would result in a decline in their aggressive behavior. The spectacle of vast multinationals contending for shares in world markets does not accord with Schumpeter's prediction of a dwindling capitalist drive for expansion. And is it really the case that a kind of ennui, a loss of belief, would overtake the capitalist world? If we were writing in the late 1960s, the prognosis would indeed seem far-sighted, for Western capitalism then seemed clearly moving toward a kind of planned economy. 20 years later, the prognosis is less convincing. Not just in the United States, but throughout Europe, we have witnessed a revival of belief in capitalism, as the movement toward a more planned system produced first growth, then inflation, finally a loss of faith in the planning process itself. Today's mood is not the resigned acquiescence in the coming of socialism that Schumpeter wrote about. Of course, Schumpeter is writing about the long run, and we are criticizing him within the time frame of a short run. The revivalist spirit may well prove to be short-lived, and the drift into a kind of mildly socialistic capitalism may resume. Perhaps the movement into bureaucratization will eventually take priority over the drive for business dominance, and the great multinationals will settle down into a kind of giant cartel, dividing up the world into private economic kingdoms, like the imperialism of a century ago. These are no more than speculations. But Schumpeter's vision is also a speculation. One kind of plausible capitalism, but not the only kind. His scenario may be brilliantly illumining, but it does not emerge from the preceding development of the system with the same logic as we find in the case of Ricardo or Smith or Marx. This is because Schumpeter's prognosis is not ultimately an economic one at all. It is, rather, a set of often shrewd assertions about social and political matters that cannot be predicted with the assurance that enabled Smith or Marx to erect their formidable theories. The disaffected intellectual who plays so large a part in spoiling the outlook for Schumpeter's capitalism cannot be said to obey the same imperative as does the accumulating capitalist or the competitive merchant. The businessman who decides that the game is not worth the candle is bowing to cultural, not economic pressures. Indeed, is it not Schumpeter's triumphant final conclusion that the processes of economics are not sufficient in themselves to determine how the system goes? His vision, then, cannot be judged by quite the same criteria as those of the other worldly philosophers. His is not so much an economic prognosis as a historical one, a judgment about the direction from which the winds of cultural change would blow. With his aristocratic taste, his aloof scholarly stance, his hard experiences in real politics and enterprise, Schumpeter may have been better placed to pass judgment about the drift of things than Keynes, to whom worldly success came too easily, or Marx, to whom it came not at all. Yet the cutting edge of his insight was gained at the expense of the strict economic logic that gave such power to the visions of the classical seers. The implications of Schumpeter's thesis are disquieting. Not merely for capitalism, but for economics. Was not the great achievement of the worldly philosophers their ability to deduce the direction in which society was moving? Is not economics built on the capacity to predict, in the large, if not in the small? And does not the Schumpeterian scenario mean that all that is now past, that whatever the predictive capability of economics, it no longer matters? We will turn back to this decisive question in our last chapter. But we are not quite finished with the quixotic figure of Schumpeter himself. There remains that last twist to his story. We shall see that it adds more than just an insight into Schumpeter's biography. Let us begin by reflecting again on the central contradiction in Schumpeter's depiction of capitalism. It lies in the juxtaposition we find in his theory of economic development. Capitalism portrayed as a static, inert, changeless, circular flow. And as a system caught up in a dynamic of change, a dynamic that would later be called the gale of creative destruction. How could Schumpeter have allowed himself to depict the system in such inconsistent terms? What possible sense does it make to speak of a changeless circular flow as representing the quintessence of a system that could also be characterized as a continuous process of self-created transformation? We know Schumpeter's explanation. The circular flow allows us to appreciate the impact of entrepreneurship, not merely as the driving force within capitalism, but as the source of its unique flow of profit income. But there is another way of interpreting Schumpeter's odd juxtaposition. Schumpeter's entrepreneurs, let us recall, do not come from any particular class. They are simply the possessors of a talent for innovation. Capitalist development is not therefore intrinsic to capitalism as such. It is the dynamization of society at the hands of a non-capitalist elite. There is no doubt that Schumpeter himself was a believer in the importance of elites in history, minorities of individuals with unusual gifts. Let us read what he has to say about them in his Theory of Economic Development, where he takes the case of musical ability. We can assume that every healthy man can sing if he will. Perhaps half the individuals in an ethnically homogeneous group have the capacity for it to an average degree. A quarter in a progressively diminishing measure, and let us say a quarter in a measure above the average, and within this quarter, through a series of continually increasing singing ability and continually diminishing number of people who possess it, we come finally to the Carusos. As it is with singing ability, so it is with the capacity for leadership, including economic leadership. About a quarter of the population, says Schumpeter, is so deficient in this quality that it is consigned to the most routine aspects of economic life, the clerks and functionaries of the business world. Then comes the next half, the possessors of a normal amount of innovating capacity. Here we find practically all business people, who rely mainly on the comfortable ruts of experience, but are capable of adapting themselves to the normal range of daily challenges. From there we reach the true elite. People who are a type characterized by supernormal qualities of intellect and will. So history, that is, history as a narrative of change and development, is the story of the impact of elites on the inert mass of society. In different social settings, the qualities needed to exercise influence will change. Military talent has its place in a feudal society, economic talent in a market society. But the driving force of an elite of one kind or another is always there. Thus, the echelon of leaders constitutes a special group. As such, it assumes its rightful place at the apex of society. There the leaders may change, but not leadership. The upper strata of society, Schumpeter writes, are like hotels which are indeed always full of people, but people who are forever changing. What we have here is yet another thrust at Marx, directed at the Marxian idea of the revolutionary force of the proletariat. All wrong, says Schumpeter. The proletariat cannot be the force for change, because by virtue of its sheer numbers, it must mainly lie in the normal range of humankind. Individual proletarians may possess leadership capabilities, but leadership itself can be possessed only by a tiny minority. Perhaps this is why Schumpeter is so philosophical about the advent of socialism. For who will run the managerial economy that he envisages as the end product of capitalism's decline? It will be the possessors of ability, of course, the bourgeoisie. Here is a class, he writes, which by virtue of the selective process of which it is the result, harbors human material of a supernormal quality, and hence it is a national asset, which it is rational for any social organization to use. So there is no reason for the managerial class to fear socialism. The skills needed to direct a socialist system are sufficiently like those needed to run an advanced capitalist one that the bourgeois elite will find its natural position at the top. Is this a theory of economics? Not by any of the conventional conceptions. It is better described as a theory of historical movement. Economics merely describes the means by which such movement takes place in a society that rewards skills exercised in the marketplace rather than on the battlefield or in the pulpit. Thus, Schumpeter employs his economic model to flesh out a larger vision. The word is Schumpeter's. In his magisterial survey of economic thought, on which he was working at his death in 1950, vision lies at the center of things. Analysis may be the great glory of economics, but analysis does not spring full-blown from the mind of an economist, any more than Minerva from the brow of Jupiter. There is a pre-analytic process that precedes our logical scenarios, a process from which we cannot escape, and which is inescapably colored with our innermost values and preferences. Analytic work, writes Schumpeter, embodies the picture of things as we see them, and wherever there is any possible motive for wishing to see them in a given rather than another light. The way in which we see things can hardly be distinguished from the way in which we wish to see them. Is economics then a visionary science, an analysis of worlds we wish to see or cannot help ourselves from seeing, rather than a detached and objective dissection of a world that is unambiguously there? We will come back to this question in our next chapter when we try to weigh up the accomplishment of the worldly philosophers and of economics as a whole. One last knot remains in the string. We recall the young Schumpeter thrust into the milieu of an aristocratic school in Vienna, where he absorbed the values that were to become so important in his own life. Are we mistaken in seeing those values transferred to his own vision of history, in which an elite becomes the central moving force? Certainly this elite is an aristocracy, embodying the belief in the natural superiority of the chosen few that lies at the core of all aristocratic views of society. But notice that the Schumpeterian few are chosen not by blood, but by intellect and will. It is thus an aristocracy of talent. This is the elite to which Schumpeter belongs. The drama of history, as Schumpeter envisions it, thereby justifies not only capitalism, but Schumpeter himself as a member of a group whose historic place rests on something more durable and worthy than mere name or birth. Thus, there is a final congruence between personal experience and historic vision that unravels many contradictions. This is perhaps not an assessment that Schumpeter himself would have welcomed, but neither would he likely have denied it. He aspired to be a great economist. Whether that was the wish that life had denied him is not clear. It is interesting that Schumpeter would never lecture on his own theories, despite entreaties from his students and colleagues. One scholar has suggested that it was because he felt that in the last analysis, his formulations were inadequate. We do not know whether he aspired to be a great visionary. That he certainly was. As analyst or visionary, everyone interested in economics must come to grips with him, not only because of what he accomplished within the discipline, but because in his very achievements he demonstrated its limitations. Chapter 11. Behind the Worldly Philosophy. The Last Chapter. We have reached the end of our book, and it is time to reflect on the journey. And so our attention moves from the achievements of individual worldly philosophers to their collective achievement, the vast undertaking of the worldly philosophy itself. Looking back over the works of a handful of remarkable men, what can we say of their project? How successful were the great economists in discovering order and meaning in social history, to repeat the words of our introduction? To what extent does economics enable us to perceive a structure behind the confusion of daily life, a drama within the whirl of events? These questions lead us to think again on the two aspects of economics that came to the fore in our last chapter. Let us begin with prediction. Did the great economists really believe that they could predict the course of events? Yes and no. All of them projected economic trends and tendencies into the future. The nearest to an economic agnostic was John Stuart Mill, who presented his readers with a catalog of possible paths toward the stationary state, depending on whether, for instance, population increased faster than capital accumulation or vice versa. But even Mill had a most likely choice among his options, and most of the great economists, as we have seen, presented their readers with but one path. Of course, none of the economists was ever so foolish as to think that society ran on economic railroad tracks. Perhaps the closest to an outright ironclad prediction was Malthus' implacable first essay on population. Yet we recall that this was followed within a few years by the much more hedged and circumspect second essay. Even Marx, who was regularly cited as the great predictor and who did indeed speak of the laws of motion of the system, was in fact extremely cautious in his pronouncements. Marxists still argue, for example, as to whether he saw the leap from capitalism into socialism as inevitable. The reason for the absence of outright unqualified predictive statements is not difficult to find. Prediction is hard enough in all but a few sciences, such as astronomy or physics, where things take place in the undisturbed laboratory of space or in some man-made approximation to it. In the social world, we do not find a setting in which things can work themselves out free of the disturbance of extraneous forces. Society, which is the social observer's equivalent of the universe, is constantly being shaken up or disrupted, sometimes by the incursion of nature itself, more often by the fact that the planets and atoms of society, its institutions and individuals, have the annoying habit of taking matters into their own hands and behaving in ways that have no counterpart in the behavior of real planets and atoms. Hence, the great economists do not write about things to come as if they were making specific forecasts for the stock market, but as if they were tracing out the long-term consequences of underlying tendencies. "A public mourning," writes Adam Smith, "raises the price of black cloth." We smile in appreciation, but is this a prediction? Not exactly. It is imaginable that the next public mourning would not raise the cost of black cloth if, for example, cloth merchants happen to have on hand a very large supply of cloth left over from a previous mourning. But, of course, that is not what Smith had in mind. He meant that, in general, and assuming there were no unusual circumstances, an increase in the demand for a good would raise its price, at least in the short run. And under the kinds of behavior that we find in his depiction of a market society, it will. The same is true when we find Ricardo stating that an increase in population will raise rents. That, too, is not exactly a prediction, insofar as the next increase might not raise rents if, for example, there was an unusually large crop owing to good weather. Ricardo is not predicting that each and every increase in the number of mouths must raise rents, but giving us a generalization in which the vagaries of weather or other intervening factors have been set aside. Thus, the great economists were general prognosticators rather than specific predictors. By that distinction, we mean that they were confident they could discern trends within society because there were regularities of behavior on which a social theorist could depend. Adam Smith's prognosis about the price of black cloth rested on his confidence that when the demand for a good increased, its price rose. He saw this as a matter of such self-evident common sense that he did not stop to mention it, but it is on the basis of such common sense generalizations that Smith and all his successors based their pronouncements with respect to the future. The generalizations, or laws, were not meant to apply unambiguously to real life. On the contrary, they assumed that the event in question would take place in some sort of timeless next instant, without the disturbing effects of changes in the background situation, such as the tastes of buyers and sellers. Therefore, if any particular event did not live up to expectations, the overall prognosis contained in the laws was not thereby disproved. Only a prolonged run of events, sufficient to describe a trend, different from that which was expected, would disconfirm a scenario. What could cause such a departure from the path implicit in the original theory? We will see shortly. But it must already be evident that economics can venture its prognostications only if two conditions are fulfilled. First, behavioral regularities must govern the actions of individuals in society. Without them, there can be no laws and therefore no possible basis for anticipating the future with any kind of scientific assurance. Are there such regularities? The great economists certainly thought there were. We recall Adam Smith's workers and capitalists, both out to better their condition. Another regularity, once very widely held to be true, was the Malthusian reflex. Higher wages invariably led to more population. Marx proposed the never-ending capitalist drive for expansion. Keynes discovered a reliable propensity to save part of any increases in our incomes. As our examples make clear, not all economists built their theories on the same regularities or interpreted them in exactly the same way. Yet all depended on some form of regular and therefore predictable economic action or reaction. Perhaps the simplest and yet most fundamental was that buyers would seek the cheapest market and sellers the dearest. Second, prognostication rests on the belief that the outcome of economic behavior will constitute the central guiding influence on the evolution of society. All the worldly philosophers recognized the importance of politics, culture, manners, and the like, and many of them esteemed these aspects of society much more highly than its grubby economic involvements. Nonetheless, they also believed that the outcome of those grubby involvements would play a crucially important role in determining the overall shape of things to come. Smith's generally sanguine outlook for society was, of course, based on his expectation of a long upward course of economic growth. Marx's vision of capitalism's fate derived entirely from his understanding of its economic laws of motion. Keynes's hopes for his grandchildren rested on his conviction that the instabilities of capitalism could be remedied. These conditions for economic prognosis make it clearer why Schumpeter marks such an inflection point. For in both respects, he departs from the basis on which his predecessors made their assessments of the future. First, he no longer regarded the economic activities of the system as essentially fixed. On the contrary, it is crucial to his outlook that the behavior of its main actors will change. Smith's and Marx's capitalists remain accumulators to the end, but Schumpeter's turn into bureaucrats. Second, he is the first of the worldly philosophers to project a logical economic scenario, and then to declare that it would not serve as the basis for social evolution. As we have seen, economics becomes subordinated to political and sociological processes. And so we return to the question of prognostication with a new sense of its importance. Prediction of a special kind is indeed part and parcel of the economic project. Its laws may not enable us to see very distantly or very clearly, but before we describe their limitations, we should note how remarkable it is that they exist at all. For we do not have laws of behavior in political or cultural or social activity that begin to match those of the marketplace. It may seem a small thing to declare that buyers seek low prices and sellers high ones, but the consequences that can be drawn from such simple generalizations are astonishingly complex. No such simple, calculable framework of explanation exists to predict the actions of kings or congressmen or voters. The behavior of children, parents, teachers, or students. The tactics of generals or the discipline of soldiers. The searches of scientists or the course of criminal activity. Economics may not be even remotely capable of duplicating the predictive capability of astronomy or chemistry, but it is nonetheless distinguished from its sister social sciences because it has some such capability. Now we must ask, how much? One limitation is immediately apparent. The scenarios of the worldly philosophers are time-bound. Smith's vision, which was a spacious one, did not extend beyond his century into the next, for the wealth of nations holds not the slightest hint of the industrial capitalism that was to replace the pin factory with the steel mill. Ricardo's remarkable model of an economy running up against the barriers of agricultural fertility did not envisage the England of Alfred Marshall's time, 50 years into the future, in which agricultural rents would already be a minor element in the economy. By the time of Mill's death in 1870, it was already abundantly clear that his imagined stationary state was only a figment. Marx's prognosis was more resistive to the erosion of events, but 50 years after his death, one could see in the Great Depression both the confirmation of his scenario and its disconfirmation in the first experiments with a state-supported economy. Keynes lived almost long enough to discover that buttressed capitalism would develop its own dysfunctions, inflation prominent among them. And we have already seen that Schumpeter's general predictions, although still relevant, already show signs of becoming obsolete. What accounts for the boundedness of these previsions? A major reason that applies particularly to the work of the earlier economists was their failure to anticipate the advent, or the consequences, of technological change. Smith did not foresee the coming of industrial capitalism, because the techniques of mass production were still 50 years in the future when he wrote. Ricardo did not perceive that the strategic sector of the economy would move from the farm to the factory because he did not see the impending generalization of steam power and iron machinery. Indeed, until Marx, no one fully appreciated the technology-generating force of capitalism itself, or fully realized the effects that technology could exert on the course of economic events. One illustration of this technological blindness was the failure of the early economists to understand that machines might displace labor, giving rise to a kind of a man-made counterpart to population growth. Smith assumed that the addition of machines would add to the capacity of masters to give employment to men, as perhaps it did when machines were little more than elaborate tools. Ricardo, we remember, was the first to see that machinery might actually take the place of labor, but he considered this little more than a possibility, a curiosum. Not until Marx was the displacement of labor by machinery integrated into the workings of the system as a whole, and Marx's analysis is still in dispute today. A second reason for limitations in the prognostic ability of economists has to do with changes in the prevailing social rather than the technological setting. Throughout the 19th century, for example, the working class steadily became more militant, not, as Smith expected, more spiritless. Smith's harmonious scenario rested on a firm sense of the stability of the social order, certainly not on a prospect of class struggle. Another instance is provided by the tension between the idea of democracy, with its implicit commitment to equality, one person, one vote, and the idea of capitalism, with its explicit inequality of economic position. Marx's expectation, or hope, for a social revolution was based on his belief that this contest could not be peaceably resolved within the framework of a capitalist society, and the principal reason that his laws of motion have so far not run their course is that this expectation has proved to be untrue. A third instance brings us to the emergence of government as a center of power capable of intervening decisively in the economic system. Such a conception was as foreign to the great majority of 19th century economists as the operation of a Japanese type of state-managed capitalism is still foreign to a majority of 20th century ones. Thus, the foresight of even the greatest economists has been bounded because they were unable to see around the corners of history and espy changes in the institutional or technical framework within which the economic activities of the actors took place. Capitalism, as a historic era, seems to have turned these corners three or four times, moving from mercantile beginnings into a period of pre-industrial capitalism, roughly from Smith through Ricardo, then into an epoch of industrial capitalism, extending from Mill and Marx through Veblen. Thereafter, into a stage of guided or supported capitalism, beginning with Keynes and continuing in our own day. And now, perhaps, into a new epoch of global markets and high technology. Within each of these epochs, the ideas and visions of its worldly philosophers opened a logical avenue into the future. But each vision reached only as far as its prevailing technological and institutional framework permitted. When a corner is reached, the prognosis no longer pertains. The actions of buyers and sellers in the marketplace may remain the same, but in an altered setting, they give rise to different consequences. A mismatch in the marketplace is one thing when the parties are pin factories, another when they are steel mills. This brings us to the third and perhaps most disconcerting reason why the prognosis of economics is limited, a reason that applies with special emphasis to our own times. It is that the regularities themselves are no longer so regular, that the predictable responses on which economic science stands may no longer be so predictable. Here enters Adolf Loew, of whom the reader has caught a glimpse in our preface. Like most economists, Loew has long been fascinated by the problem of order in society. The astonishing fact that freely acting human beings, cooperating and colliding with one another in pursuit of their private economic goals, could bring about a coherent solution to a problem they never even posed to themselves, namely the provisioning of the community as a whole. However, unlike most economists, Loew has never explained this capability as a kind of natural outcome of a market system. Rather, he asked, what sort of behavior is necessary to achieve this remarkable result? And then he asked, what sort of social setting is needed to give rise to this behavior? And then finally, what happens if the social setting is not the one we need? The answer to the first question is well known to economists. Market behavior results in a workable economic society only as long as each person behaves more or less as Smith's personae did. This means that economic order depends on a society in which buyers and sellers alike are continually forced to maximize, that is, to seek their immediate pecuniary advantage. Only when individuals behave in this fashion can we depend on the market mechanism to perform its social alchemy. What only Loew pointed out, however, is that precisely this kind of single-minded acquisitiveness arose in the social circumstances of pre- and early industrial capitalism, when mass poverty, a competitive civil order, and the avid pursuit of economic success produced the very behavior needed for economic order. Now comes the problem. The conditions that gave rise to maximizing behavior are progressively eroded as capitalism develops. In place of poverty, we have rising mass well-being, to the point where we need advertising based on Veblenian values to create the demand once provided by sheer need. In place of the scramble for immediate gain, We have a game of musical chairs played to slower tempos as large-scale enterprises establish long-term strategies that would be quite beyond the power of small firms struggling to stay afloat in heavy competitive seas. And where once the market mechanism alone brought about most social outcomes, there is now the government placing itself above and against the market. All this may be very good for the residents of a market system. No one would wish to go back into Dickensian capitalism. But the advance carries a severe price, for the kind of behavior necessary for economic order is less and less the kind that emerges from the pressures of the changing social setting. Capitalism becomes more affluent, but as a consequence it becomes less self-regulating. Order is increasingly imposed on the system from without rather than arising from within. And now comes Lowe's most serious contention. If modern organized capitalism cannot any longer depend on the spontaneous forces of the market to assure its orderly operation, economics itself also changes its relationship to society. As long as the laws of behavior could be discerned at work within the system, economics could be a passive pursuit, a detached contemplation of the workings of society. To be sure, the observers might strongly urge this or that social course of action. All the great economists have been profoundly concerned with what they deem to be the right policies for government to pursue. But these recommendations were based on the firm assumption that the system left to itself would otherwise follow along the route down which its behavioral regularities drove it. But the change in the social setting of modern capitalism rules that out. To be effective, economics is now forced to become an instrument of active interference with the course of things. Its function is no longer to predict or prognosticate, because that is no longer possible. The new function of economics, the only function left open to it by the increasing indeterminacy of behavior, is to control the economy. By control, Lowe does not mean authoritarian central planning. Rather, he seeks the task of economic control as guiding the system to a socially desired goal through appropriate market behavior. Behavior may be made appropriate by very mild policies, such as tax inducements, or it may be steered by bolder government actions that directly affect supply and demand. Mild policies or not, the task of economics can no longer be what it once was. The old economics was, so to speak, philosophical economics. The new economics will have to be political economics, a discipline that must discover the economic means to achieve politically chosen ends. Is Lowe's diagnosis right? Is the economic system becoming less self-ordering, more dependent on non-market forces for its adequate performance? It is a plausible thesis. Will economics therefore become of necessity less contemplative, more intervention-minded? That is more contestable. As we saw in our last chapter, there is a widespread disillusion today with planning. The other side of that coin is a celebration, almost a worship, of the market as the instrument to which we must entrust our fate. The economic vessel may need political economics as a new steering mechanism. It may nonetheless spread its sails, hoping to catch the old trade winds. That decision hinges on an aspect of the worldly philosophy that we have frequently noticed but not explicitly identified until now. This is its visionary aspect, the pre-analytic, to use Schumpeter's word, grasp that singles out this or that motive as the most powerful driving force, or this or that idea as the most powerful meaning to be perceived in history. Schumpeter's conception of the importance of elites is one such pre-analytic vision, but it is certainly not the only one. Smith's whole worldly philosophy was shaped by his view of human history as a stage-like process in which societies progressed from one level of material and cultural achievement to another, until humankind finally realized the conditions needed to achieve a society of natural liberty. Marx's vision is related to Smith's, insofar as human emancipation is surely his great theme. But it differs in perceiving that what Smith calls a society of natural liberty is still a class society, far from the classless society to which humanity must make its painful way. Mill, too, projects a vision of human improvement as the fundamental teleology of history. His view of a society of self-realizing individuals is more radical than that of Smith, more conservative than that of Marx. Keynes, too, builds his system on a vision compounded of the ideas of the liberal philosopher G. E. Moore and of the great political conservative Edmund Burke. What can we say about such varied projections of the imagination? No doubt all of them contain their elements of personal biography, so vividly implied in the case of the young student thrown into the company of aristocratic schoolmates. Certainly they evidence that rationalization of interests and predilections that Schumpeter calls ideology. But it would be terribly wrong to overlook the core of intellectual penetration and emotional courage that marks all these great visions. Marx said that to be radical was to go to the root of things, and that at the root was man himself. In that sense, all these visions are radical efforts to take the measure of man and the collective life that he has created for himself. One thing only can be ventured beyond these very general remarks: the importance of visions in casting and plotting the scenarios of the worldly philosophers suggests that the scenarios themselves cannot claim to be based on irrefutable and unarguable facts. To put the matter differently, the wide spectrum of its underlying visions implies that economics itself is not a final, irreducible level of social understanding. Economics deals with the complex outcomes of social processes, including the act of exchange, the drive for capital expansion, and still other behaviors that we call economic. But these behaviors themselves reflect the historical or human setting in which they are found. The acts of exchange or accumulation are building blocks from which economics is constructed, but the building blocks themselves contain the relationships of mutuality and domination that lie within or below all social life. At the root of the matter lies man, but it is not man the economic being, but man the psychological and social being, whom we understand only imperfectly. Economic understanding is a marvelous chapter in humankind's autobiography, but it is neither the first chapter nor the last. Are there worldly philosophers today? There are certainly a vast number of economists, over 20,000 of them in the United States alone. Never was the profession so visible or so ubiquitous. There is a council of economic advisors. It is food for thought that there is no council of political advisors. There is a Nobel Prize for economics. There are economists in every bank and corporation. There are economists in the newspaper columns in the morning and on the television broadcasts at night. If prominence is the standard, this is par excellence the age of the economist. But are they worldly philosophers? Not if we mean by the term great prognosticators or great visionaries. With very few exceptions, the Nobelists are not much interested in the construction of grand models of economic development. Paul Samuelson, the first American prize winner, is famous for his pioneering work in mathematical economics. Other laureates have been honored for the refinement of powerful but essentially neutral techniques: econometrics for testing hypotheses about economic relationships, or input-output analysis for analyzing the connections that link the system together. Still, other Nobelists have worked in pure theory, demonstrating, for instance, the possibility of, or the precise conditions for, the attainment of a general equilibrium in the system. Thus, if economics is much in the public eye, the work of the leading economists is not much in the tradition of the past. A few figures have become widely known for their economic philosophies. One thinks of Nobelist Milton Friedman, who has forcefully preached the virtue of the free market, which was not the achievement that won him his prize. Or of John Kenneth Galbraith, who has equally forcefully preached its obsolescence. But in the main, economics has become a technical, often arcane calling, and ambitious projections of imagination into the future are no longer listed among its aims. It is noteworthy that even Friedman and Galbraith are more interested in criticizing the mistakes of the present than in creating models of Smithian or Marxian or Schumpeterian scope. Why has economics lost interest in the idea of a worldly philosophy? It is certainly not for any lack of immense economic problems or difficult economic prospects. One does not have to be an economist to know that enormous economic problems loom ahead. There is the lurking threat of depression and inflation, the still far from resolved problem of the economic instability of the system. There is the newly arisen challenge of the globalization of the market, altering the economic geography of production in ways that threaten the very foundations of the older industrial states. There is the festering issue of the dependency of the poor countries on the richer ones, and of the counter-dependency of the rich on the poor. There is the ambivalent promise of technology, bringer of material well-being and ecological danger, of economic growth and employment shrinkage, of life and death. The problem is that the resolution of these issues, whose outcome will so profoundly affect the prospects for capitalism, will not be resolved by economic forces alone. Before these forces play their role, a prior decision will have to be made as to how large that role will be. Depression or inflation, international production and finance, global indebtedness and technological disruption are all economic problems whose course and consequences will be primarily determined by whether or not they are consigned to the determinations of the market or to those of government. Lowe may or may not be right in judging that economists must alter their conception of what economics can do, but it seems incontestable that political decisions will set the stage for what the economy does. If these decisions incline in favor of giving the market its way, we will have one kind of scenario. If the political pendulum swings again toward the general guidance of economic affairs by the state, we will have a different kind. Neither kind can be written in advance. The economic and political forces are too complex. All that can be foreseen is that each scenario presupposes a different setting within which the great issues will have to be resolved. A determination in favor of the free play of economic forces will consign this fateful resolution to the individualism and energy of a market society, along with its instability and moral blindness. A determination in favor of planning will consign the resolution to the exercise of political decision-making, along with its bureaucratic tendencies and inefficiencies. It is this choice between competing settings that must be decided before we can try to construct a logic of historical movement for our time. In either case, of course, we will have economics, market economics, or political economics. That we will again have a worldly philosophy seems unlikely. The setting of modern life does not accommodate the kinds of prognostications expounded by the great economists. We may have great visionaries, great builders of systems, but these systems and visions are not likely to have the powerful simplicity of the worldly philosophers. Their narratives were written during a time when the economic workings of society were thrust into a historic centrality that they are not likely to occupy again, even if we opt for the market over planning. And so we must in all likelihood write finis to the worldly philosophy. There will be no more social dramatists who dare to base such large-scale narratives on so narrow a motivational base. Yet the worldly philosophers will not be relegated to the museum of ideas. If their expository narratives will not suffice in a world in which economics will never again rule as uncontested as in the past, there will surely be efforts to create new narratives in which the logic of economics is buttressed by, or possibly subordinated to, logics of politics and psychology. Whether such deeper and broader scenarios of historic movement can be forged, we cannot tell. But one thing seems quite sure. As few other thinkers, the worldly philosophers taught us to see the evolution of society as a drama whose meaning could be grasped by individuals who would otherwise have felt themselves merely swept along by overmastering and incomprehensible forces. The ultimate objective of their economic thinking was social understanding. That extraordinary lesson for human emancipation will not be forgotten. This concludes the reading of The Worldly Philosophers by Robert L. Heilbronner.
Copyright 1986 by Robert L. Heilbronner. This recording of the reading of The Worldly Philosophers was published by arrangement with Robert L. Heilbronner and was produced in 1992 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without the prior written authority from Blackstone Audiobooks.
This book was read by Mary Woods. If you would like to receive a free catalog listing our complete line of audiobooks, call toll-free 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. Thank you.